Okay, I think it's 1:15, time to get started. Perry Marshall is going to talk about Evolution 2.0, and the rest of your title doesn't jive with the one in the book, so
that's okay.
I'm going to let you take it from there.
All right. Hi, my name is Perry Marshall. I'm delighted that you're here. I'm from Chicago. Got a wife and six kids. I'm a marketing and business consultant. I'm best known for writing the world's best-selling book on Google advertising. I also wrote a book called Industrial Ethernet in 2002, which I had no idea when I wrote it that it was going to have a great deal with me being here today. I'm going to tell you what I consider to be the biggest untold story in the history of science. And you can decide if that's too tall a claim or not. But when I went down the evolution rabbit hole, it ended up being far more fascinating than I ever suspected that was going to be. And it started in that little bus in 2004 having an argument with my younger brother. My younger brother went to Master's Seminary, John MacArthur School in California, got a master's degree. When he was done with that, he moved to China, teaching English and being an undercover missionary. And he was there for 4 years, and when he came home, he was almost an atheist. And we are very close, and the emails were going back and forth the whole time. And his perfectly coiffed Excel spreadsheet of exact answers of how everything works started to fray. And quickly found, as soon as you change one thing, and all of a sudden everything was up for grabs. And he is very smart, and he was asking very intelligent questions. I had done lots of apologetic stuff. I'd gotten a Willow Creek and Cedar Small Groups and all kinds of stuff like that. I thought I'd seen everything, I hadn't, and he was asking really great questions. And we're sitting in this bus. I was visiting him in China, and I found myself floundering, and so then all of a sudden I go, all right, so do you actually believe that the hand at the end of your arm is the result of, like, a bunch of random accidents? And he was ready for that question. And he had your sort of standard neo-Darwinian answer. And even though I didn't really buy his answer, I knew there was a lot of biologists who would agree with him. And I knew that I didn't know. And I decided, I'm going to find out. And in fact, I was already pretty unsettled about a lot of issues by this point in my life. And to some extent, I decided to let science settle the God question for me. Now, this freaks some people out, but the way I read Romans 1 is, for God's eternal power and divine nature are revealed in nature so that all are without excuse. So I said, okay, all right, I'm an electrical engineer. I know certain things in engineering really well. I'm very comfortable with some parts of science, and electrical engineering and science are more exact than biblical hermeneutics. And I also decided that Jesus said the truth will set you free, and I figured that was probably true whether Jesus was the Son of God or not. So I'm just going to go after the truth here, and I just kind of flung myself into the void. And what am I going to find out here? And so for several weeks or longer, I floundered around in the food fight that goes on between the two sides, and I bought tons of books and I started reading papers and trying to get literate about this. And it was very, very uncomfortable for a while. It was very scary. But I finally reached this point. Something happened that for the first time made me feel like I had actually touched the bottom of the swimming pool, or at least gotten to some kind of principle that I can work with. And here's what it was. I wrote a book called Industrial Ethernet in 2002. And I was studying DNA. I was trying to understand DNA mutations. I was trying to understand all of that. And I was digging and reading and digging and reading. And I suddenly had this epiphany that the data structure in DNA is remarkably similar to the data structure in an internet packet. Things similar to the multi-layered model of communication, which any communication engineer clicked in place, that's there. Things like checksums, Hamming codes, redundancy, error detection, error correction, repair systems. That message didn't come through. Please send it again. In fact, it was scary how similar these two things were. And because I had worked at a software company for 4 years where we designed communication protocols for industrial equipment, and to me this was not black magic, I all of a sudden was like, okay, I can work with this. And evolution can be seen as a software engineering problem. Okay, now we're starting to get somewhere. Well, so I started working on that. And I had a friend at Willow Creek, biggest church in Chicago, who knew what I was doing, and he invited me in to speak. And I went and I gave this talk arguing for design based on the genetic code. And the talk was called, "If You Can Read This, I Can Prove God Exists." Now, that's probably sounds a little strident, and I approach it a little bit differently now, but I gave that talk, and I put it on my website, and I was driving a lot of traffic to this website, I don't have time for that story, and I had tons of people come to this site, and this eventually resulted in somebody putting a link on Infidels, the world's largest atheist website, on their forum, and he said, "You guys be nice to this guy while you're up in distress." And all of a sudden, now I'm having to defend myself on Infidels. Well, that became the longest running, most viewed thread in the history of Infidels, and they never cracked my syllogism. Now, the syllogism was this. So when I say DNA is a code, here's what I mean by that. To have a code, you have to have an encoder, a message, and a decoder. And that's exactly what you have in DNA. You have a DNA strand, that's the message. You have an encoder, which is the process of translating, transcribing DNA into messenger RNA. And then you have translation from RNA into amino acids. And that is a communication system as formally defined by Claude Shannon in 1948. And any communication engineer can then take that and understand it and analyze it in terms of data density, noise, all kinds of stuff like that. And so I ended up with a syllogism that goes like this. The pattern in DNA is a code. All codes we know of the origin of are designed. Therefore, we don't have proof that DNA is designed. We have 100% inference that DNA is designed, and we don't have any inference to any other explanation. Now, I know what some of you are thinking, which is, well, yeah, okay, that's great, but that's a God of the Gaps argument. Well, it is a God of the Gaps argument. And I don't think God of the Gaps arguments should be used to prove God. I think they should be used to drive science forward. Okay, and so the result of all of this is that I've organized a technology prize. I have a group of equity investors who are backing me up, and our proposition is this. If you can show us a code that's not designed, nobody gets to cheat. But if you can get it to self-organize or something like that, first of all, if you can do it, the spec is at naturalcode.org, we'll write you a check for $100,000 and shake your hand and congratulate you just because you did it. If, however, the process you use to do it is patentable, if it's defensively patentable, we will spend the money, get it patented, and when the patent is granted, we'll write you a check for $3 million and buy the patent rights from you. Why is that valuable? Because it's artificial intelligence. Okay? If you get something like that to self-organize without cheating, you accomplish something that is a very big deal. And if you listened to the Origin of Life presentation yesterday, you know how thick and difficult this problem is. Well, that only gets you to about 5 or 6 years ago. Now, the prize is new, and it's kind of one of the cornerstones of my book that's coming out in September, but there was a whole other piece of the story. So it's like, okay, I have very strong indications that there is design in biology at some level, but what about evolution? And for about 2 years, maybe three, I was just undecided about it. And I would watch the ping pong ball go back and forth and back and forth. And basically for me, it was like, well, it sure looks like this evolution thing happened. But on the other hand, as an engineer and all the other things that I know, nobody is giving me a satisfactory explanation for how this actually works. They never taught me about random mutation and natural selection in engineering school. And if you're an engineer, you don't get to take 10,000 computers, jam them into a random mutation natural selection machine, and go out for a three-hour lunch and come home with your software written. That doesn't work. Okay? Evolution is one of these things that appears to be water flowing uphill. We don't know how to make things that evolve, but living things evolve. And then I made a discovery. Well, the question, in my, as I understood it, was, what is the nature of the mutations that allegedly drive evolution? Now, you'll find like a million websites that say things like what Richard Dawkins says in his famous book. Mutations are the random changes in genes that constitute the raw material for evolution by non-random selection. Well, once I realized that the DNA transcription translation process is a communication channel, what Richard Dawkins is saying is that you add a little bit of noise to the signal and it occasionally gets better. Now that sounds plausible to most people. If you're a communication engineer, you know that's wrong. There is no such thing anywhere in communication theory as here's the percentage of time that noise makes your signal better. People have no idea how many systems of checking, rechecking, and re-rechecking go on just for you to have a cell phone conversation driving down the highway, and two-thirds of your data bill is redundancy and resend of the packet so that you get it and have a seamless transmission. Noise is always your enemy. Therefore, the mutations that drive evolution can't be random. It's not possible. Well, let me skip. Here's what I found out. I had a major epiphany when I discovered the work of Barbara McClintock. In 1944, she was bombarding corn plants with radiation and seeing what happens when she broke their chromosomes, and she's kind of throwing the plant a curveball, and the plant threw a curveball back at her. And to make a long story very, very short, because we're so limited on time here, the plant repaired. There was a missing part of the chromosome. The plant couldn't reproduce. So in real time, the plant went and copied another part of another chromosome that was not the same, but an adequate substitute, patched it in to the missing DNA and repaired itself and was able to go back and reproduce, and the plant had evolved in real time. And she did this in 1944, and she gave a presentation at Cold Spring Harbor to her colleagues, where half of them were mad at her for suggesting such a thing, and the other half laughed. She stopped publishing her work publicly for 20 years, but she won the Nobel Prize in 1983 for discovering mobile genetic elements. Okay? Now, this was what I was looking for. I knew I was looking for something. It was like, maybe the cell has some kind of an innate ability to know what to do. Well, that was just the tip of the iceberg. There's another mechanism called horizontal gene transfer. And if you got strep throat, you're taking antibiotics, and your antibiotics are killing those bacteria. Those bacteria will go around, and they will look for other cells, other bacteria, whatever they can find, that perhaps has a pump. I got a pump that this poison out. What am I going to do about this? Ooh, I found a cell that has a pump. Let's take its DNA, splice that DNA, find the part that codes for pump, insert the code, read the code, build the pump, pump the poison out, then update my USB stick, also known as a plasmid, with new code, start sharing that code with all my bacteria friends, and now we've all got pumps, and then I divide off other bacteria, and they have pumps too, and guess what? The antibiotic doesn't work. So you gotta kill those suckers dead, you gotta finish your bottle of antibiotics, otherwise the bugs become super bugs, and this is why. And what I just described can happen in 30 minutes. Random my foot. This is not random. Lamarck, 200 years ago, said offspring can receive inheritable traits, learn inheritable traits from their parents. The neo-Darwinist said that's ridiculous. Turns out epigenetics is one way that this happens. And epigenetics is basically, this is an epigenetic metaphor. Flight 6429 was delayed from Chicago to Winnipeg, and you gray out a bunch of letters, and now you have Flight 29 to Winnipeg. You can change the meaning of a coding sequence without changing the sequence by graying it out, and that's what epigenetics is. Symbiogenesis. Algae plus fungus equals lichen. Eukaryotic cell plus blue-green algae equals plant cell with chloroplast. A chloroplast is a blue-green algae that is reproducing in lockstep with its host. Every green thing you've ever seen in your life is a result of an ancient symbiogenesis event that got carried forward. Okay? So there's like this modular Lego block-like activity that organisms use when they want to cooperate with each other. A mitochondria is the oxygen equivalent of the same thing in an animal cell, and a mitochondria cell can survive on its own if taken out. Okay? Symbiogenesis. Mechanism number five is hybridization. An example of hybridization. So hybridization is when you have a creature with a certain number of chromosomes and you breed it with a slightly different species with the same number of chromosomes and you get a hybrid with double the number of chromosomes and which is also a new species. This is how we got wheat. Grass plus weed equals wheat. Tunicate 1 plus tunicate 2 equals hagfish, which is a vertebrate, whereas a tunicate was an invertebrate. A hybridization event created vertebrates, so far as we can tell. Now, everything I've been describing to you are things that are actually done in real time in the lab. None of these are just wild speculative theories. Now, This particular one is, we think this is what happened based on the DNA record, but we produce hybrids like literally every day. Botanists do it all the time, and it's less common with animals. So.
You're at the 20-minute mark.
Okay, so let me finish up. So, I have a book called Evolution 2.0, Breaking the Deadlock Between Darwin and Design. It's coming out September 1st. It's already on pre-order on Amazon. If you have Amazon on your phone, you can order it, and it'll come to you in about 5 weeks. The surprising thing when I got this book done was who ended up liking it. And I got the most positive feedback from actual secular scientists who are doing this kind of work. This guy, for example, Kwang Jun, from the University of Tennessee and editor of the International Review in Cellular and Molecular Biology, wrote me a glowing endorsement and said that he ordered several copies for his grandkids so that he can explain to them what he does. I didn't know that he was a Christian before I went and hunted him down, but turns out he is, and he did a very successful symbiogenesis experiment where he got microorganisms to merge together. And so I've actually got very good endorsements from some scientists in the field, and I want somebody to win our prize. My posture with this technology prize is, see, you're wrong, you don't have an answer, you can't figure it out, therefore God exists. I think that's disingenuous. The ID movement kind of does that, and it irritates scientists. I'm saying this might be solvable, and if it is, let's name it, let's identify it, let's reward it, let's see how we can use it. If any of you think that this is interesting, go ahead and you can pre-order the book on Amazon. Who's got questions? Yes, sir.
So, I'm not an information guy, but there's this weird thing where in adding noise to a signal, sometimes the signal becomes detectable when it otherwise wasn't.
Yes.
I just wonder if there could be some bizarre analogy to that really does allow a mutation to be helpful.
The simple answer is no. There are names for that. So one name for that is dither.
Stochastic resonance,
yes, and those things exist. However, they don't create new information. They just push the variations above the threshold of detectability. Who else has a question? Yeah.
So you claim that the bacteria in your strep infection are seeking out this random. What is your evidence that they're seeking it out? Because bacteria who aren't involved in a strep infection are also picking up DNA from their environment by horizontal gene transfer. It's just that they don't have a selective advantage because their environment
isn't pulling off if they don't pick it up. Well, so a good example would be cholera, which like goes out on like a slash and burn mission, just like looking for, I mean, it's actively looking for something. I read an article about this not too long ago. One of the other indications is that when, even just with transposition, bacteria not under stress have a mutation rate of less than one mutation per billion letters. When they're under stress, starving, something like that, the mutation rate goes up by a factor of 10 to the power of 5. And so it's like there's a crisis mode that they switch into and start actively seeking. And this is the thing that people have almost always been taught in biology from freshman on, that evolution is not directional, not purposeful, not teleological, and I'm saying that is emphatically wrong. It is intentional, it is directional, and it has something to do with what the creature is trying to accomplish.
I think biologists would say that it is not random in that it depends on the environment. And so the mutations occur, they occur at different rates under different conditions. But what you need is a change in phenotype in order to change. Right.
Right.
Nobody cares if you change the code if you don't change the phenotype.
Right. Right.
So there are structures in place to allow that those changes in phenotype, but you're only selecting based on what that particular environment is.
Well,
the bacteria are not seeking out an epsilon-resistant gene.
Well, so
if you put tetracycline in your body instead, they're not hunting out tetracycline. They are surviving because they picked up a tetracycline-resistant gene instead of an epsilon-resistant gene.
Well, so I don't think enough experimentation has been done to prove the assertion that they are not selective in what they're looking for. The assumption that they're not looking for anything is itself an unproven assertion.
Well, you need a, so if you go back to your engineer, you need a sensor for that, right?
Well, so cell have lots of sensors. They sense lots of things in the environment, and the genetic changes are context dependent.
Are you aware of the age test?
No.
So what you do is you take a particular gene the bacteria needs so that you break it with a single point mutation, and then you give different molecules that will cause mutations randomly. So bacteria retain, if they happen to mutate that one gene back, those ones will live. And you can tell how many genetic compound is by how many of those back mutations you have. So the bacteria aren't looking to remove that back mutation back. They're just randomly being mutated all over the place. And then if one happens, they're not looking for the phenotype. They're just giving lots of different mutations that you can select from.
Okay, so I would strongly challenge what you just said, that they are doing that randomly. I don't think they are.
Mutagen is doing it randomly. It's like intercalating between different parts and just causing... The mechanism for this is very well known.
Okay. But what the bacteria do in response is not random. I think there's some kind of mathematical matrix that is saying these kind of changes are more desirable than others. And I think my time is up.
Your time is up.
Sorry. Thank you. Appreciate it.